welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. We have a lot to bring you today. In the second half of the show, Matt Olien reviews the movie TD. It's one of the better coming-of-age movies Matt has seen. And Dave Thompson and I will review this week's news. But first, we want to talk about parents who now, maybe for the first time, have seen their kids off to university or college. How can they cope? Some parents use social media to find friends for their lonely kids or set up cleaning services and crowdsource advice on how to interact with roommates who take up all the fridge space. How do you let go and trust your kids to make good choices without your help? Our first guest is clinical psychologist Dr. Helen McKibben, author of Drop, Making Great Decisions. She has over 30 years of experience using neuroscience to help people retrain their brains to make better choices, trust those decisions, and erase self-doubt. She gives ideas on how to not be a helicopter parent. Dr. McKibben, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you, Craig, for having me.
This is an interesting topic. What are parents to do when their kids go to college? Are their kids on their own, or are the parents in about everything that they do? So I'm going to start out this discussion with your best advice on how parents can effectively balance giving their college-aged children independence while still showing some support.
Well, when I tackle a problem as important as this, I like to do two things. I need to outline why is this happening? Why is the worry happening? And what to do about it? Because my whole life's work is giving people a method to fix things that may not be working, with the parent worrying or the child worrying. So the first thing I'd like to do is define what's going on here. Decision-making is something that starts in early childhood. And for all the parents who are listening, listen, you may hear yourself in my description of how children are parented. But if a child has a feeling reaction or a read of a situation like it's tense or an idea of something they really, really want to do, and the parents, the caregivers, reinforce and support how that child feels or what they observe, yes, it is tense, or what they want to do, great idea. The child, after 2 to 5 years of reinforcement from those caregivers, grows up and they go into adulthood trusting the way they feel to make decisions, trusting their read of a situation and plotting a course for themselves accordingly, and listening to and following through with their ideas. And that begins at childhood, but it lasts forever. The child has the ability to make their own decisions. If, however, in opposition, for whatever reason, lack of a parent being around or parents parent us the way they were parented, and the child has a feeling reaction or a read of a situation or an idea of something they really want to do, and the parent's response is, well, why didn't you punch him in the nose instead of, oh, yeah, I got angry too when someone punched me, you know? Or, hey, it isn't tense. You're making me tense. Go play. And the child walks away second guessing themselves. I thought it was tense. There must be something wrong with me. Or, hey, mom and dad, I want to build a kite that looks like the Washington Monument. And the parents say, well, great idea, but do it exactly this way and get first prize. So we have two extremes there. But as the listeners think about it in their own upbringing or in their parenting, their own, you know, child from 3 to 23, it doesn't matter. Does the child get reinforcement for how they feel, what they observe, and what they want to do? If they don't, they shut down listening to themselves, as I said before, and flip into a dependency on reading their parents, who they love very much, for what to feel, what to do, and what to say.
Just if that has happened from elementary school through middle school through high school, and now our son or daughter is in college, boy, things are difficult, it seems to me.
Things are difficult because they emerge and leave the parental home, like going to college. All of a sudden, instead of reading themselves, they were used to reading the parents, so they're reading everyone else for what to feel, what to do, and what to say instead of themselves. And that is a problem, because people read that they're not secure in their decision making. It may attract people who bully them. It may attract people who are very difficult. So my life's work, if that occurs, is to give the child and the parent a simple methodology based on neuroscience to reverse that, not getting enough reinforcement growing up, to a young adult or even a parent who now has a method to go back and redo what they didn't get growing up, to listen to how they feel, what they observe, and what they want to do. It's very, very important. So as the parents who are listening say, well, is it too late? I mean, maybe I did this too much. I didn't reinforce enough. It's never too late to reinforce your own child becoming independent and making their own decisions based on how they feel, what they think, and what they want to do. If they don't, we have all sorts of problems.
Dr. McKibben, there could be some parents who are listening that are saying, heck with that. I know best. I'm not changing a thing because I can guide my son or daughter better than he or she can guide themselves because I've been through it. They haven't. Therefore, I know best. I'm not going to change a thing. I've got my phone. I can text them 20 times a day, or I can FaceTime them here right now. I could be a helicopter parent, even though they may not think of themselves that way, because I know best. What would you tell those folks?
That if their child is dependent on their guidance, they're going to transfer that dependency to other people that they have no control of, and it's not going to be good.
So you're saying that if I depend on my parents for everything, then all of a sudden other people are going to be able to control me in a way, even though I'm unaware that that's happening?
Unconscious and automatic, yes. Wow. And there's another complicating factor. Not only does the child who doesn't get enough reinforcement for how they feel, what they observe, and what they want to try to do, they flip into a dependency on reading the parents that they love very much and vice versa. And then one more thing happens. Not only do they start reading other people, but because they're so dependent on the parent, this dialogue starts coming in their head. I call it a critical voice, having them second guess everything they're doing, what they're saying, what they're feeling, and what they want to do. Carrying that parent in their head with them. Yes.
The little shoulder thing left and right here that are yelling things in our head. Don't do that. Don't do that. Tell me, what's your definition of a helicopter parent? How would you define that?
Someone who is reenacting what was done with them.
Let me ask you this question. How can that be if, my parents didn't have cell phones, they didn't have FaceTime, they didn't have these mechanisms to talk or the expectation to talk with me instantly, yet now I can talk to my kids instantly. Is there still some transition there?
Yes, because what happens if the child is so dependent from hearing that parent, then they lose focus on their classes or getting to know other people. They're constantly second guessing themselves in their thought process unless they hear from that helicopter parent. So I don't have the answer of perfection for the adults who are listening, but is there a way for you instead to use empathy, not advice, with your child who is away at college? Is there a way for us to shift from the child calls and says, this girl is treating me really bad and I don't know what to do. And the parent, if they use my method, pauses with themselves, gets memory recall of when they felt that way and say, I remember my first year at college when I felt like that. And I had to go to counseling for a while and figure out who I was. What do you think you'll do? Instead of advising them, then the child learns to start listening to and emulating the parents who make good decisions because they listen to themselves. Now they have an opportunity to listen to themselves and share with the parent some of their ideas that work and some didn't, and start to become independent.
What are the early warning signs that you might tell parents so that they can recognize, oh my God, I am one of those helicopter parents and I didn't realize it. What questions should parents of new college students be asking themselves as their kids maybe are in college now for the first time?
One symptom is akin to addictive thinking, that the parent finds themselves so anxious and unable to stop strategizing day or night on how to help the child. That means the parent may be running from their own feelings and insecurity and fears about letting go of the child. So they have to have a method to notice their overthinking and strategizing for their child, go through instead the feelings or fears or worries that are there, and then approach with empathy, not advice.
So how then should parents deal with social media and their kids? Would you say a hands-off policy might be the best way to just not even look at your child's social media following, posts, etc.?
No, my job is never to tell people what to do. My job is to have them look at and use a method to, when triggered, drop until they're back to neutral, which activates the brain's memory recall. And when they find themselves wanting to use social media or tracking their child, be sure that they go through the feelings that are attached for themselves before they respond to the child, not immediately reacting, trying to fix everything for the child. So the parents have their own feelings to deal with, including loss of a child, and the child needs to learn how to feel on their own to make good decisions.
We're enjoying the conversation with our guest, clinical psychologist, Dr. Helen McKibben. She's the author of Drop, Making Great Decisions, which introduces a groundbreaking technique for overcoming emotional triggers and making better life choices. Let's get more into the drop technique, could we?
We can, but I would like to give a little preview that would help your listeners understand. My definition of homesickness is a child who does not know how to make their own decisions. And what they crave and why they want to go home is they've lost their structure and footing where the control was done for them, whether that's what they ate, what they did, what, you know, the rules, everything. And all of a sudden they're on their own and they might not have a way to make their own decisions. So they're feeling very lost. And I feel homesickness, or that yearning for structure that they've lost growing up and were dependent on, is very important. So let's give you a methodology to deal with it. I use neuroscience in the brain in this way. I do not use mindfulness. I do not use meditation. CBT, having the parent or the child go up and talk themselves in or out of why this is happening. I use a simple method that does this. It notices every time the parent or the child is upset by where they light up physically. I have them shift and notice exactly where they're lighting up physically, which stops an immediate reaction, whether that's calling the child 10 times a day or the child calling the parent 10 times a day. I ask them to drop back to neutral, and this is what it does. When they notice they're triggered and upset and they go through the feeling, the brain's whole job is to configure every time they felt that way before, what worked for them, what didn't work for them. The brain is already designed to use how you feel in the moment and every time you felt that way before to make new decisions. If a child did not learn to listen to their own thoughts, feelings, and ideas growing up, they don't have the ability to get that memory recall involved in their own decision-making, which is so important. That allows the child to be independent and start remembering, oh, you know, I ate a whole pizza last night, but I got really sick. Instead of calling mom, if I pause with myself a moment and recall the way I ended up feeling after eating that old pizza, my brain is designed to redecide what I'll do next time, which is I'll have only a piece or two. That decision-making is what resolves the feeling for the child so they don't have to have the dependency on calling the parent to fix them or tell them what to do. And this is not just about food choices. This is about sleep. This is about how do I not attract difficult people? This is how do I take tests, perform in athletics, use substances in a very appropriate way. Every decision-making element that child is going to need in making choices living separately from the parent is incorporated in using this simple method, and I'll repeat it for you. Notice I'm upset or triggered by I light up, not cognitively waiting for my brain to say, you're angry. I light up. That's the cue to shift and go back to neutral, which activates the brain's memory recall. In nanoseconds, the brain processes how we feel in the moment and every time we felt that way before and spits out words or ideas of what you could do so you don't feel that way again. So it's a system that is set up in the brain in the way it's already designed to advise good decision-making. And why is that important? Then the child walks away not thinking about it anymore. Or the parent walks away not thinking about the Facebook and the social media. They have said or done what they need to for themselves, both the parents and the child.
So my son or daughter is in Maine, where I'm visiting with you today, going to school. Yet we still have contact, and I see a train wreck coming. I see it. I can tell that whatever it is that I'm thinking about, that they are doing, it's not going to end good. There has to be a role for a parent here still. How do
Absolutely.
We know? What do we know about when to say, here we go?
I say it's memory recall. The parent, let's say two examples. That's the parent is calling and, Mom, stop calling so much. I can't think. My counselor says you're not supposed to call me that much. That shifts the responsibility back to the parent to not call a psychologist, but to pause with themselves long enough to get memory recall. And they call the child back. And you know what they say? You know, I remember when my parents did this to me. And so I'm really so glad you're so honest with me and telling me that I need to take a little break. I know we'll work this out. Let me know what you decide. You're a good decision maker.
We would generally, when our kids were in school more than a decade ago, when they were in college, visit about once a week. But I wonder, we didn't have, or at least we didn't take advantage of social media, FaceTime, texting, and all that kind of stuff. We just called once a week. How's it going? What's new? Et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure you would advocate for that. But is there a regularity that communication should occur in your view?
I can't tell people what to do, but I can say two things. Be sure you drop to what I call the blank screen or neutral before you call your child. Drop to that neutral or blank screen and get memory recall in what happened the next last time I called them. Be sure that when the parent is making decisions, they use the brain and the way it's designed for how they feel in the moment and every time they felt that way before, what train wrecks occurred when they tried to advise their child, for example, and drop long enough to make a different decision of what to say or do with that child. So it's not the amount of time. The other factor is empathy, not advice. That the parent drops long enough to get memory recall of times they were struggling with what the child's talking about and say, I remember feeling this way. There's nothing wrong with you. I had to learn to do this. What do you think you will do? Instead of telling them what to do. Because in the throes of a feeling reaction at college, whether it's someone not treating them well or them gaining a few pounds or athletic performance being bad or someone they drank too much, they only have their own brain and experience and memory recall to redo those decisions. They can't keep calling a parent every minute of their lives. You know how many decisions we make every day? Hundreds. And it's the decisions are made based on memory recall. And if one of the memories is, Mom and Dad always told me what to do, and all of a sudden Mom and Dad start using empathy instead of advice, they all of a sudden go, it sounds like they trust me. And so there's a shift. There's a recognition and a communication with the parent about decision-making, but not a dependency anymore.
Is physical distance important for a young person when they leave the nest, so to speak, to get a little farther away from Mom and Dad? Is that part of the puzzle here?
It's a very interesting question. It depends on the family situation. It depends on what they're used to. Sometimes people like to be a little closer because they're afraid they're going to get homesick and need to go home every other weekend or something to get what they're used to. So I don't think the distance is the issue as much as when they call and how often they call or text or get them help or get someone to be their best friend, it's be sure that the parent's anxiety isn't transferring to the child as they give them all this advice, that the parent who's dropped through their own anxiety, listen to their memory recall, and is communicating with the child with empathy, not advice.
Are there times when spouses can't deal with not having their kids in their homes? And is there something they should think about as they're becoming empty nesters, that they have now this really a new life?
Interestingly enough, parents can run from their own feelings and issues by parenting a child. And all of a sudden, the child isn't present and all the feelings they hadn't been managing start coming up. Conflicts in their marriage, feelings they've never dealt with. Why didn't I do this in my life? And it is important that they notice they're triggered by where they light up, pause with themselves long enough to get the brain giving them some words or ideas about what might be going on that hadn't been resolved in the past, and start managing their own emotions, number one, for themselves, and number two, so they don't transfer the anxiety to their children.
What are you working on? What's new now? You've written the book, Drop, Making Great Decisions. What are you doing next?
I am waiting to see if this simple method based on tapping into the brain and the way it's already designed to resolve feelings and make great decisions is going to be helpful for other people. I've worked for decades in helping people, but I'm widening the audience to everyone to see if it'd be an effective method to deal with every time they're triggered to feel, every time they're second-guessing themselves, or every time they're triggered to feel, or every time they run into a difficult person. This method is applied in the book to so many different situations, including how do I raise a child that goes into adulthood with high self-esteem? So the very thing we're talking about is addressed in the chapters.
Dr. McKibben, we have about 30 seconds or so, maybe a minute left. Have you had a chance to visit directly with students whose parents were in that place of being a helicopter parent, working with them, and then had a successful outcome where both parent and child flourished in a better way?
Yes, and this is the way it happens. The child gets better first, doesn't have a dependency on the parent, and then the parents start noticing that because of that absence, that focus on the child is gone, they have to start maybe getting into their own therapy or learning how to manage their feelings other than controlling an outcome with their children or anybody else.
Dr. Helen McKibben, you can learn more about her new book, Drop Making Great Decisions, online at helenmckibben.com, where she has free resources to show you how to use this revolutionary technique in your daily life. This is an interesting topic, and there are a lot of parents that are listening or wondering, am I that parent or not? So thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me. And the book will also help the children if they're looking on how to manage their new issues that they're dealing with in their college life.
I wonder if this will appear under Christmas trees and somebody might read it and go, Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Okay, thank you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
After the break, our news director Dave Thompson and I will review the news, and our great movie critic Matt Olean reviews the movie Dee Dee.
I'm Ann Alquist, director of radio at Prairie Public. Whenever I travel, I always look for the public radio station on the dial. And no matter where I am, I know I'm going to stay connected to what's going on in Washington, D.C., that I'll be surprised and delighted by a story, and that I'll get a feel for the local community. But to learn more about this unique part of the world, I turn to Prairie Public's team of experienced news reporters and engaging conversationalists on Main Street. Thank you for tuning in and being part of our region's stories.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
And there
there's our tune that announces Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's news director, is with us again here on Main Street. Dave, you're about ready to go on vacation.
I am, Craig. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Well, I hope you have a great time. In the meantime, let's talk about this week's news. Governor Burgum has forcefully, as perhaps anticipated, really ripped into this property tax elimination measure that we're all going to get to vote on.
Right. And now, what he did it publicly in front of his Main Street summit. Now, not really surprising. He's not been a fan of property tax relief at the state level because he said the state does not, you know, levy property taxes. The reform ought to be coming from the local level, you know, maybe putting caps on property tax increases, rather than having the state fork out money to pay for some of the things that have been paid by local taxpayers. He has said that since he introduced his income tax proposals during the last legislative session.
I should point out the amount of relief that we would experience from his income tax proposal is much less than the tax relief we would experience from a property tax elimination.
That's correct. But the legislators are now wondering, if this passes, where are we going to come up with the money? Because a baseline, you're talking over $1 billion.
Is there any new discussion about that? Because this has been on their minds now for quite some time, and all of a sudden, here we go. The election's not far away.
So this is interesting, and I'm going to look into this a little bit further. Measure number one on the ballot has to do with kind of limiting what you can do with the principal of the our sacred wealth fund, the legacy fund. And is that going to play into it? I'm not saying it will or it won't, but the fact is that you need a two-thirds vote of both houses of the legislature, and you can only access 5% of the legacy fund. Well, that may sound kind of really very much putting the screws to it. When they put in the first one where it was two-thirds vote for spending up to 10% of the principal, they were only expected to be $1 billion. It's over a $10 billion thing. So there's a lot of chess pieces at play should that property tax measure pass.
Dave, will people make the connection between those two different resolutions that really they're related, but will they make the connection at the ballot box?
You know, it really is kind of two different issues in a way, but you're right, there is a connection there, and I don't know if they're going to make it. I don't know if I were coming in blind, you know, looking at a ballot issue, I'd probably say, great idea, and then you vote for the property tax, and that puts a little extra pressure on the legislature.
All right, Dave, this is the new segment that we're done with. We're going to turn and now make you a meteorologist for just a moment anyway.
Oh, hey, I almost got my degree in meteorology, my bachelor's at UND. So,
well, you could talk about this then. The early data that we're seeing is pointing to, and I'm putting it in air quotes here, a typical winter. Now, Dave, I'm going to say last year's winter, at least here in Fargo, was typical, just for the sake of this discussion.
Okay, well, you know, typical winters are, you know, about 30, 35 inches of snow during the winter. Not last year, it wasn't. Now, we've had a couple of years of what they call the El Nino winter. This is going to be a La Nina winter. Supposedly, that's what it's shaped up to be. And that means we'll probably get normal precipitation and normal cold temperature. We're not going to see perhaps as cold a winter as some, but we're going to see more normal temperatures, more normal precipitation. That's what they're predicting now. That could change.
So, Dave, what you're saying is that getting through a winter last year of never using my snowblower isn't going to be the case this year?
Probably not. Probably not. And I'm kind of hoping that I don't have to spend several nights at the radio station.
Let's hope that that's not the case.
Yes.
I'm not going to take you to sports now, Dave. We're going to go back to news, if that's okay. A tragic story. A Dickinson man is dead after an officer-involved shooting.
Yeah, that was something else. And this happened basically yesterday. We're speaking on Wednesday. It happened on Tuesday. Happened early in the morning that a highway patrol trooper attempted to stop a driver who was driving erratic on Bismarck Expressway. He just turned on the Bismarck Expressway from 12th Street, heading west. Wouldn't slow down, wouldn't stop. Then the driver got off at the first Mandan exit on Bismarck Expressway and then got back on, and the patrol kept, you know, pursuing him. A Morton County deputy put down these strips that blow out tires, the tack strips, and he got the tires blown out, and the guy got out of the car and started shooting at the officers. The officer shot back and we have one dead. The woman who was with him was not injured, not hurt, and is cooperating with police. A couple of officers from the Highway Patrol and a couple of deputies are now on administrative leave pending an investigation, which is common in this type of thing. But one thing they did say, they did not, you know, have time to talk about drugs or booze, but they have sent the body for a toxicology report, part of the autopsy.
Tragic stories.
Very tragic.
It is rare in North Dakota when officers are involved in shootings, though, it seems to me.
No, it is. It is very rare, thankfully. I mean, we had the incident in Fargo, which was terrible. Mm-hmm. But that was really out of the ordinary when that one happened.
Dave, somebody you know and a key figure in the deleted emails case, you can remind us what that is, but Chief Deputy Attorney General Troy Seibel has passed away.
He has passed away. And this has been such a weird thing because after Wayne Stengem passed away suddenly, or right before he was to take another term in office, the emails were deleted. They were deleted by his administrative assistant with Troy Seibel's blessing. Now, you can read into that what you will, and there are several different theories on that, but this has led to a whole discussion about when one leaves office, should the email stay as part of the record? So there's been a lot of discussion on that.
There's been some work by a school choice task force, and now they have published a meeting notice. Many of their meetings have been not public before.
Now, this is kind of interesting. It's probably a little bit of a leak, if you want to put it in North Dakota's open meetings law. A legislative committee was assigned the study of school choice. But they formed this subgroup, and because they said they formed the subgroup without legislative imprimatur, they could meet, you know, behind closed doors. But they now have decided, because there's a spotlight on it, they're going to meet in public. I don't necessarily think there was nefarious reasons to meet behind closed doors, but, you know, if you wanted the spirit of open meetings law, well, that's probably not a good thing to do.
There's a special competition happening at NDSU, Dave.
This is kind of interesting. Now, you've heard of Star Wars. What about
sure.
What about Score Wars?
Ah.
You're wondering what Score Wars is. These people, they're targeting high school and college freshmen who like to compose music. So what they've done is this week they started on the 3rd of September. NDSU has a major. You can get a degree in, you know, composing. And the head of that department said, okay, we're going to do this kind of like we're doing Iron Chef. We're going to bring these people in and give them subjects there to compose around. Then they have time. Then they're going to be performed by some NDSU students who are in the music program. And they will be judged, yay or nay. And that is four rounds. There are going to be four rounds of that, with the end round going to be, I believe, in late October, early November. Could be kind of fun, I think.
I don't know that I could compose anything. I
can compose a letter.
who can put their thoughts to music and then tell a story with it. I think there's a special, I guess, trick to doing that. I don't have it, so.
I don't have it either, so.
Good for them. Dave, remind us about the debates that are coming up, would you please?
Well, we have several debates. I believe the first one's the House debate between Julie Fedorchak and Trigvi Hammer. That's one I'm going to be moderating. Then the governor's debate, which has three candidates, of course, I'll be debating that one. Matt Olien's going to take the U.S. Senate debate and also Minnesota 7th District Congressman debate. The year's all coming end of September, early October.
And those will all be broadcast live here on Prairie Public Radio, also on Prairie Public Television Service. Dave, what's your team working on?
There are some interesting things. What we've heard is that the Republican Party has put out a call for election watchers, election integrity people. They're calling it the Election Integrity Project, kind of looking into that to see what that means. And, of course, there's some other things going on that they haven't come to fruition yet. They haven't quite gelled, but I have an interview this afternoon that maybe Main Street might be interested in about the ambassadors, how ambassadors are picked. And you may think of ambassadors as just a U.S. ambassador, but these people who serve in that service serve in other jurisdictions.
I would like to know more about that, Dave.
Could be kind of fun.
We review the news each and every week with our friend, Prairie Public's longtime news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, I think we're going to miss a week or so because of vacation, but we'll see you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Craig. We'll see you.
Travel safe.
Thank you.
Read all about it. Gather around, everybody.
More Main Streets ahead, a movie review from Matt Olien, the movie Dee Dee, and Matt likes it. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. When it comes to philosophy, no one is more influential or invoked than Plato. He set the agenda for everything that came after him, and that's probably an understatement. But that was 2,000 years ago. Should we still read him? Does he deserve the praise he gets? Let's find out. Join me and my guest, Marina McCoy, for Is Plato Still Relevant? On Why Radio, this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Heard the fanfare, that means it's Thursday, and it's time for us to meet Matt Olien here on Main Street. Matt is going to review another movie. Matt, what do you have?
Dee Dee, D-I-D-I, that is a term used in Asian culture for little brother.
All right.
This is the new film from Sean Wang. Sean Wang is a director who recently had the documentary Oscar-nominated short 9A and WIPO, which also played at the Fargo Film Festival and won some awards with us. He's now moved into feature filmmaking with his first feature, Dee Dee.
Matt, let's take a look at the trailer.
What was your name again?
Chris. All my friends just call me a Wang Wang.
And what should I call you?
You're never gonna survive high school.
You're like a lizard with your scaly eczema skin.
Pizza face!
Ah, lizard
Just call me a
Nobody likes you.
All right, Matt, we've now listened to the trailer of Dee Dee. It's a coming-of-age film for sure. This is one that you've really, really liked, I think.
I did. Set in 2008 in California, it follows this 13-year-old boy, Chris Wang, who is, you know, obviously, this is a semi-autobiographical film by the director, Sean Wang, and part of a recent kind of pattern of filmmakers making movies about their upbringing. You know, Spielberg's The Fablemans, Sam Mendes did a film like that, Lee Isaac Chung's Minari. So it's like a pattern of filmmakers kind of talking about their youth, semi-autobiographical. They use different names, but it kind of chronicles their youth as they moved into movie making. So it takes place in California, 2008, kind of at the dawn of social media, okay? That's a big part of this movie is MySpace, Facebook, you know, the initial Facebook launch by Zuckerberg, and how kids communicate online and how things can be misconstrued and how things can be awful online. So you get quite a bit of that as Dee Dee, Chris Wang is the boy's name in the movie. You know, Dee Dee is, of course, what he's referred to as little brother. He lives with his mother, his grandmother, and his sister Vivian, who he bickers with all the time. She's about to head off to college. So Chris is going into ninth grade in high school. It's the summer before ninth grade. He's got friends. He's nervous. He's kind of withdrawn. The actor Isaac Wang, who plays Chris, plays the boy basically poker face. This kid hardly ever smiles. He's very, you know, quiet as that awkward age. The film reminded me of Bo Burnham's wonderful film Eighth Grade, which came out a few years ago, which was so amazing, which kind of captures that awkward age of that transition from middle school to high school. So love this movie. It really captures all of that. It also captures what it's like for Chris to grow up in a Taiwanese-American family in California, and he's kind of embarrassed by his Asian heritage a little bit as he tries to fit in with these skateboarding guys who he videotapes and makes videos for, but he also makes a lot of mistakes in the movie. There's a girl he likes. It's kind of that awkward kind of first foray into romance. Not going to tell you what happens there, but what I liked about the movie, too, is not everything turns out okay. You know, some movies, some coming-of-age movies, by the end, everything's fine, everything's great, as he starts ninth grade. That isn't always the case with this movie. And I think that's why the truth of it, of what Sean Wang's upbringing was like, really comes to the fore. Wonderful performance by Isaac Wang as Chris Wang. Shirley Chen plays his sister Vivian. She's really good. Joan Chen is kind of the name actress in the movie. She plays the mom who's always at odds with her kids. And the dad is not around. He's making money somewhere else, sending money back. So it's a very tense kind of family situation, a lot of bickering, a lot of things like that that are very typical with teenage kids, right? We've parented sure. teenage kids, Craig. It can be difficult at times. The back talking, the snide remarks. It's all there in black and white. So really, yeah, really like this movie a lot. It's not shot with any kind of glamorous cinematography or flashy direction, but it's real, right? It's a real story about a real 13-year-old navigating, making mistakes.
Matt, what I wondered about this movie, I have not seen it yet. I've watched the trailer. We plan to see it for sure. I do think it sounds really good, is how the intersection of culture mm-hmm. and cultural identity really kind of intertwine here. And sometimes I think that's hard for directors to get right in a movie when they're intersecting mm-hmm. Taiwanese culture, in this case, with American culture. How'd that work?
Well, it works because this is what Sean Wang grew up with. So he knows what his upbringing was like in California. For example, Joan Chen is the mother, and then her mother-in-law that lives with them, they mostly do not speak English around the kids. And then the kids will respond by speaking English. They're Americanized. Chris and his sister Vivian are completely Americanized. They don't have accents. They have American accents, right? So they speak in English back to the mother and the grandmother. And so that's really interesting to watch. And I have to believe that is how it really happened with Sean Wang's family growing up. I would say, if you have not seen his documentary short, Nine A and Waipo, it is so good. It was an audience favorite at the Fargo Film Festival. It's a real story about his two grandmothers, which are very important in Taiwanese and Asian culture, as they are in any culture. But he captures that push and pull between being Taiwanese American and just being American, right? It's that identity thing. At one point in the film, Chris kind of lies to his friends that, oh, my dad's not Asian. My dad's white. That comes back to bite him because you got to tell truth, right? So there's a lot of that cultural intersection, him navigating this. Even the girl he likes, she didn't mean it bad when she says it to him because she's being nice to him. But she even makes a crack about him. You're kind of cute for Asian. There's little cracks like that in the movie that feel real because I have to believe they really happened to Sean Wang in reality growing up in 2008.
This movie has a great Rotten Tomatoes rating.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, it's been critically acclaimed in certain circles. May not have the chutzpah, though, for the Academy Awards.
Yeah, good question. You know, Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade, I thought, should have got a lot more awards buzz when that came out in, I think it was 2018. Wonderful movie. Just so awkward to watch this poor it was so hard to watch. The performance by the actress as this eighth grade girl was just heartbreaking in parts. And so is Isaac Wang as Dee Dee. It's heartbreaking to watch because you can see him making mistakes. Like, don't do that. Don't block that girl that likes you because you're nervous. Don't do that. Don't do silly things. But you know what? Kids do silly things, and it drives us crazy, doesn't it? But we did the same thing, and that, I think, is why the movie works, because we're watching him make mistakes, and we're cheering for him to not make mistakes.
If only we had the wisdom then that we have now.
Yes.
Matt, talk about maybe what's coming down the road.
Beetlejuice, that's the buzz. That's out this weekend. And, you know, Michael Keaton is back, Winona Ryder, Catherine O'Hara, Jenna Ortega, who is, you know, the young female actress of the moment for sure, is in it. So we'll see. You know, I'm not one of these people that loves the original Beetlejuice. A lot of people that are of a certain age do love it. I think it's a good film. I think it's a good Tim Burton film. But let's face it, Tim Burton's made some bad films. He really has. He has a very up and down track record for me, so we'll see.
This is in the fun film category for us. I don't know if necessarily we think that it's a great film, but it's in there for just fun. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, mm-hmm. Airplane,
yep.
Napoleon Dynamite, Beetlejuice.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right, Matt, let's get to our trivia question. I don't think I've asked you this before, and I hope Ashley hasn't either. Which picture won the very first Academy Award?
Wings was the best picture for 1928. The interesting thing about that first Academy Awards is there was a second award called Unique or Artistic Picture, and Sunrise got that. And then they discontinued the award the next year, and it was just Best Production, Best Picture.
That's correct. And it was a silent film.
Yes.
Name another silent film to get Best Picture.
The Artist in 2011.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Next time on The Pulse, having a boss who doesn't enforce rules may seem like a great situation, but be careful what you wish for.
Really, what we ended up with was The Hunger Games. Always uncertain, always looking over your shoulder.
How power structures at work impact productivity and how people feel about their jobs.
That's The Pulse, coming up at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 5th. When the North Dakota Agricultural College opened, the need for a quality academic library became apparent. In 1904, NDAC President John Wurst wrote to philanthropist Andrew Carnegie and asked if he would build a library on the campus. Carnegie donated $17,400. Wurst raised another $4,500, and the library was underway. On this date, in 1910, there was a great deal of excitement in Fargo. While there was enthusiasm over the laying of the cornerstone for the new library, most of the excitement was reserved for the main speaker. Teddy Roosevelt was returning to North Dakota for the event. Thousands of people descended on Fargo to hear the former president, who had fallen in love with the state. The newspapers noted that many came by automobile, with as many as 500 out-of-town cars arriving in the city. Roosevelt's speech focused on the common man. He said, "One of the most important assets of the nation is the education of its young men and women." He expressed his great pleasure that his name would always be associated with the college. He said it was not scholarship alone that was good, unless it is productive and adds to the sum of the nation's achievements. He added that too many people attending schools were overly sensitive about their rights, but not sensitive about their duties to society and the country. Roosevelt noted that he received what he called his postgraduate course in North Dakota and found it difficult to express what he owed to the state for which he felt such deep affection. In his speech, he made his famous comment that he never would have become president if it hadn't been for his experience in North Dakota, saying, "You people of North Dakota are peculiarly responsible for me. I am glad to know that you do not feel bad about it. If it had not been for what I learned during those years that I spent here in North Dakota, I never in the world would have been president of the United States. So now I feel a keen gratitude toward North Dakota, and it is especially pleasing to me to feel that I am back home again." Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
LL Cool J has been rapping since the 80s. Now he's out with his first album in over a decade, but don't call it a comeback.
How you gonna call it a comeback when I've been here for years, man?
My chat with LL Cool J, plus the latest on the school shooting in Georgia. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street on our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Both are great ways to catch up on previous episodes of Main Street. Tomorrow in this time slot at 3 p.m. Central is The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. His topic this week, what's on young voters' minds? It's a great topic in front of next Tuesday's presidential debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. You'll be able to hear that debate right here on Prairie Public. And at 7 p.m. tomorrow, we'll air Science Friday with Ira Flato. Monday on Main Street, we'll tour the Fargo Water Plant and learn about things like how fluoride is used in our water system.
That's Monday on Main Street, and we hope you can join us. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend.